Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, welcome everyone to another Wednesday evening with the Clear Mountain Monastery community. This evening, I thought to give a little roundup or overview of my time at Dharma Realm Buddhist University. So, some people will know if you've been following this channel for a while that you can't really tell where I am. I usually actually don't have the Guanyin Bodhisattva in the background here, but you certainly can't tell from anything behind that where I'm actually at. But I've been living at or near the city of 10,000 Buddhas, attending Dharma Realm Buddhist University for the last 4 years. And it is a Chinese Mahayana university. And I've been getting a bachelor's degree in liberal arts. So the whole program is not one of just Buddhism. It's an accredited university. For some reason, I always feel the need to add that in there. It's accredited, it's legit, real university. And Buddhism as a class, or Buddhist classics, are only one part of the curriculum, but for me are really at the heart of the program, along with the language study. So at the beginning of this program, you choose either Pali, or excuse me, Sanskrit or Chinese, classical Chinese, and you stick with that as a thread through your whole educational experience. And for myself, I chose Sanskrit, which is very close to Pali and certainly has improved my Pali and given me a basis in understanding Sanskrit, so for which I'm really grateful. But what this video is going to be about is how my understanding of Buddhism, of the path, of really the heart of a practice life, how that has shifted and changed over the course of these 4 years. Because I'm not only reading these Mahayana texts, which I had never read before. We have them at the library at Abhayagiri and at many other Theravada monasteries. You'll find the Heart Sutra, the Sharangama Sutra, the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, and you'll find commentaries on these, but I had never read them in full and certainly hadn't read them in a sympathetic context with an audience of, or a group of people who really take these texts as their working foundational understanding of Buddhism and of reality. So it's been a unique and really good experience overall. I was meeting with a friend this morning and I told him that I'd be talking about doing an overview of my 4 years at the Mahayana University. And he got this kind of mischievous look on his face and says, "Oh, all right, expose." Just wondering if I'm going to expose all the secrets of Mahayana tonight and tell all the, you know, all my Theravada friends about all the, you know, the dirty secrets, like a Hollywood expose or insider edition type thing. But no, it's not going to be that because really I've learned a lot and have had perspectives opened in certain ways. And it's also not going to be a full apologetics for Mahayana Buddhism. There are many things, as I'll discuss, that I don't understand, certainly about the texts and about the practice, the deeper levels. But I am sympathetic to a lot. And this is not a reveal that I've somehow become a Chinese Mahayana Buddhist on the inside and I'm just keeping these brown forest monk robes on the outside. But yeah, I thought to share my experience because it is unique. I'm a forest monk, so going to university or even doing a lot of reading is not really on the docket. That's not what a forest monk does. We put the books behind. There's an often quoted Ajahn Chah quote, which says, you need to put the books away and just read your own heart. And I'd heard that repeated again and again at different monasteries, and it points to something beautiful. If one can do that and really understand the heart and not need any kind of intellectual or academic stimulation, then all the more power to such a person, such a practitioner. But for myself, one thing I've learned in these 4 years is that, at least my conditions as they are now, I get a lot out of study. I get a lot out of hearing other people's perspectives on texts. Invariably, I always get more out of hearing other people's perspectives on a text, certainly texts that I don't understand, like many of these Mahayana ones that I've been studying, than I do when I'm just reading a book by myself. So that's good to note. I can't just, you can, take the forest monk out of the library, but you can't take the library out of the forest monk. I'm not sure if that phrase totally works through, but I appreciate study, and there's a place for it in Mahayana Buddhism, and even in Theravada Buddhism. You go to a country like Thailand, and there's monk universities. There are Theravada monk universities. So it's just this forest aspect. And again, I don't want to live in a library. I don't want to live in a university. I'm quite happy. I'll graduate in 2 weeks, and then I'll move back to Ubaigiri for 2 weeks, and then move up to Seattle long term. That's my trajectory, back to the forest, back to the land, back to a context which is less up here, less in the head, and more down in the heart, in the body, connected to more sitting, less verbiage, possibly more meditation. But that said, I certainly haven't, I've been meditating at least as much since I've been at university than I was when I was at a forest monastery. So this is a little bit of a unique case, and also just a Theravada monk coming into a Mahayana context. Mostly, as it's said in the Dhatu Vibhanga, like elements or like characters come together and associate with like elements or like characters. So usually Theravadins stick with Theravadins, and Mahayanas stick with Mahayanas. Chinese practitioners usually stick with Chinese practitioners, Thais with Thais. And of course, that's not exclusive, but it's a general, something which is observable. So a little bit of a unique thing, but I thought tonight to basically discuss my experience with a framework of 4 years, as in 4 years of my bachelor's degree, and four lessons over 4 years. And beneath that, you'll see a Theravadan forest monk walks into a Mahayana university. So that's could be the beginning of a joke. And if it is, then this talk is the punchline. And different people have thought it was a joke. You have different people's perspective. Many people thought I was coming to a university because I wanted to disrobe. But that wasn't the case, as far as I can tell in my conscious mind. Some people thought it was just a silly way to spend one's time, but I've put it to some use, and we'll see. You can be the judge of that, and I'll know my own experience. So the first lesson I'd like to talk about, which is a bit of a basis for the other lessons I'll be talking about, which are, broadly speaking, insights or spheres of insight, which, although they have kernels in the Theravada tradition or the Pali Canon, are really flushed out and fleshed out in the Mahayana exposition. So the first principle is returning to true suchness. This is a phrase which comes up in the Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana tradition. It's a sutra which is traditionally attributed to Ashvaghosha in the second century. And that's the phrasing here. And there's other phraseology which just perhaps occurs in the Pali Canon, like this word suchness. You could say that that's a translation, well, it's an English translation of a Chinese word, which purports to be a translation of a Sanskrit word, although there's no Sanskrit version of the Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana sutras that's been found. Comes from Sanskrit, which, you know, is related to Pali of tatata, or that which is suchness, or other translations are thusness. It's just a vocabulary, a way of speaking about things, which later Mahayana tradition expanded. You see in the Chan school, or the Zen school of Japan, of turning the light around. So you do see this. My understanding of this concept is basically the third foundation of mindfulness. And again, these terms are vague. They're defined differently in different Mahayana commentarial texts. Different commentators in different Mahayana countries and scholars in Western countries have different interpretations of these. But my understanding of this concept is similar to mind knowing mind. So that third Satipatthana featured in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta of the Pali Canon, which says, one knows the mind in the mind, or in and of the mind, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. And the Pali version of it is just almost that succinct. It's just a paragraph in that sutta. And there's a bit more elaboration. So how does one practice knowing the mind as mind? One knows a mind of greed as a mind of greed, a mind of hatred as a mind of hatred, a mind of delusion as a mind of delusion, a mind free of greed as free of greed, a mind free of anger and delusion as free of anger and delusion, a liberated mind as liberated, an unliberated mind as unliberated, etc. And this phrasing of true suchness, it has a risk to it, which I've worried about before, and I think does have some danger of it, of reification. It's possible when you foreground and emphasize this positive language of speaking about awareness, that you make it into a self. And it's very fundamental in the Pali Canon and many places in the Mahayana Canon, that this truth of anatta, or not self. But, and you do find in Mahayana sutras actually talk about true self. So there's a danger there. And why is that a danger? Because when you posit a self, even if it's true self, which you can define in different ways, say a very generous and charitable interpretation of, say, true self or true suchness, you know, is just that which knows. So this is a way of speaking in the Thai vernacular. So the puru being that which knows. It's a way of speaking which Ajahn Sumedho speaks to, just returning to that which knows. But the Mahayana, at least in the way that I've been come to understand it with such great teachers as Doug Powers. He's a layman who's been in the tradition of Master Hua, was a student of him since, I believe, the late 60s, with Kitty Sorrow, a former monk of the Ajahn Chah tradition, who's now a master's student and will also be graduating in 2 weeks, and who I've had the great pleasure to get to know more, and to, we go to school together, we have 15 minutes in the car together every morning, and through conversations with him, through conversations with Dylan Balmaceda, and I've done interviews with both of them, with Jin Chuanshir, a Mahayana monk who's a peer of mine, who I've also done interview with several on this channel. Their understanding and their fleshing out of this concept as being this awareness, which is, you can frame it as the citta, the mind, and it's very clear in a Theravada context, traditional Theravada, that that's not a self. And but the Mahayana language around it, you have centuries, the Mahayana canon did not close or did not cut itself off. The Mahayana canon is a very different document. It's multiple documents. Basically, each various different emperors through the course of Chinese Buddhism created different canons. So the canon of, say, the Long or the Dragon Canon of maybe the 8th or 9th century in China is different, has different texts than later imperial canons in the Mahayana canonical text, Tripitaka. So you have texts like the Six Patriarch Sutra, which, you know, was a teaching from Hui Neng, the sixth patriarch, in, scholars believe, maybe 700 AD in modern-day China. So that's part of the Chinese canon, and I believe most Chinese canons, Tripitaka sets. And he just speaks about this concept of suchness or thusness, or returning to that which knows, or the bodhicitta, or the bodhi mind, or the Tathagatagarbha, or emptiness. And I just rattled off a bunch of different words, which scholars can argue are talking about vastly different things. But for my own purposes, it's just a dropping back rather than focusing on objects of mind. So there's a way I was interested to kind of introduced to Theravada. It's very object-based. So you've got a subject, which is in the head, maybe behind the eyes. It's not really looked at much, but looking down at the nose, at the breath, in and out, at the tip of the nose, kind of behind the eyes, looking down, or visualizing a skeleton for death meditation, or reciting a mantra, which is maybe in the ears or out there somewhere, or very object-based practice, or the body, looking down at the body. Whereas what we're looking at here is a subject-based practice. So coming back to that which knows, turning the light around rather than going out to an object. So that's the first kind of insight or lesson from being at university here. The second lesson is not really something I've learned from any particular text, but more just an outlook, a feel for practice. So when you read Mahayana text coming from a Theravada background, you are, or at least I was, immediately confronted by certain doctrinal beliefs, which seem on paper patently opposite even of doctrines which are fundamental in Theravada. So an example I've given before is the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha said in the Pali Canon, it's taught again and again and again, the Buddha taught in the Pali Canon, this is true. It's not otherwise. It is as it is. But you've got the Heart Sutra, which says there is no suffering. There is no cause of suffering. There is no cessation of suffering, and there's no path. Basically, there is no Four Noble Truths. So reading that in my first year at university, it was just painful, I love the Four Noble Truths. I love my Theravada view. And it's really possible. It's the norm in a Theravada monastery. Just everybody who is kind of allowed to stay long-term either is overt and outspoken with their Theravada right view, or they just, you know, maybe they have some other views on things, but they just don't speak about them. So it's possible to just not have one's views challenged when you're living in a homogenous group, but coming to the university, everybody else has a different view. Non-dual, non-duality. So this ties back into that first, true suchness, emptiness, that which is oftentimes framed as a non-dual perspective. Whereas, the Four Noble Truths are very dualistic. You've got wholesome, that's the path, the fourth noble truth, and you're supposed to cultivate it. And you've got the unwholesome, the akusala, that's the second noble truth, and you're supposed to abandon it. Whereas the Heart Sutra just obliterates that in a certain way. Or the Lotus Sutra, which very radically says, actually, the enlightenment of the Buddha in the Parinirvana of the Buddha, the Buddha purports in that sutra, says, actually, it was just a show. I've been basically enlightened for eons and eons and eons. And I just went through this show to inspire people who could be inspired by such a thing. So very different from a Theravada perspective, which is just, you know, it's just the fact that, okay, the Buddha was unenlightened. He was a bodhisattva. Then he sat under the Bodhi tree, saw the truth of the Four Noble Truths and became enlightened. And then 40 years later, he died under the Bodhi tree and went into Parinibbana. And that was, that was it in a way of speaking. So, these somewhat big differences, it seems. And rather than go into the specifics of why one of these is true and the other one is false, I'll just talk to this attachment to views and what I have under here as the narcissism of minor differences. This is a Freudian term. And what's interesting about this term is that what it refers to is this, you know, I don't really care about the nuances of different Christian views. I mean, there's huge debate and violence of view among different Protestant sects and Catholicism to Protestantism, depending on who you ask. And for someone who's a Buddhist, it's just, they are so far away, the Christian view that, okay, you believe in transubstantiation, the blood, you know, the wine actually turns to blood, or it doesn't. It's no big deal to me. Whereas, this thing about, questions about doctrine in Buddhism, for me, it takes on hyper importance. But one might say, and this is always the case with this perspective of narcissism of, quote, minor differences, that it actually doesn't feel minor. I mean, Kovilo, are you tripping? That's a major difference, that there is no Four Noble Truths. But what's problematic here is the narcissism. It's the attachment to views, and that's pain. And the Buddha points to it. He actually labels it as, you know, some people might have a certain view and they hold to it, saying only this is true and everything else is false. The Buddha talks about this as attachment to views, or a fetter of views, a sangyojana, a ditti sangyojana, a ditti oga, a flood of views, a ditta asava, a asava or a taint or an outflow, an inflow, an influx, a intoxication of views. And that's what it feels like when you can't let something go. So whether, and being able to hold both of those things, I still love the Theravada perspective more. I love it more. I love the clarity of coherency, the clarity of specificity, the clarity of rationality, which you find in the Pali Canon. But when it becomes a conceit of coherency, a conceit of consistency, a conceit of rationality, that anything that's outside of this coherency, this consistency, this rationality, which honestly a lot of Mahayana texts seem to be from my perspective, when I hold on to that and make a problem out of it, then that's my own problem. I mean, the Buddha wouldn't have made a problem out of it. Somebody comes up, if the Buddha didn't teach the Heart Sutra, which I think most scholars do agree that that's kind of I don't believe the Heart Sutra is in the Chinese Buddhist canon. It's kind of a summary, which has been put together. But at any rate, that view, if someone came up to the Buddha and said, there is no suffering, there's no cause, there's no cessation, there's no path, he wouldn't make a problem out of it. And neither do you, and neither do I. I can still hold to that because I find that framework largely more helpful. But there's a limit to that. And I come face to face with it when someone else says something contrary. So how to not make a problem out of views. It's been a good learning experience. The next field of insight is Guanyin Bodhisattva. So I might in the coming weeks give talks or give some reflections on each one of these lessons, almost certainly give one on practice of Guanyin recitation. So being here at the university, probably the most impactful aspect of the university experience for me has been what are called CEIs, or contemplative exercise immersions, which are basically meditation retreats. And for a week in the middle of the semester, stop all classes and basically just, you know, one semester we had a Chan session. So we're sitting meditation, focusing on either a koan or just looking for that which is looking for the knower. Or another year we had a Guanyin recitation. So we're reciting Guanyin's name. And this is something which is traditionally not done in Theravada monasteries, because Guanyin isn't really, or even Avalokiteshvara isn't mentioned in the Pali Canon. But I found it helpful. There's an interesting sutta in the Pali Canon where the Buddha says, I hear that you denounce all ascetic practices. Is that true? And the Buddha says, no, that's not true. And someone else says, I hear that you praise all ascetic practices. Is that true? And the Buddha says, no, that's not true. And so they ask for clarification, and the Buddha says, I praise those ascetic practices, or those disciplines, he uses several different words, or those exercises which lead to the arising of wholesome dhammas and to the diminishing of unwholesome dhammas. And I found the exercise of reciting Guanyin's name a helpful exercise. Why is that? I'll go into it more in the video, but suffice to say, I think there is something to be said for the capacity for prayer, or even asking for help. Really, I do hold to the Theravada right view that I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, whatever I do for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. The idea, which I think is in many people's minds when they invoke Guanyin's name, invoke Avalokiteshvara's name, as a way of petitionary prayer or of supplication, like if I just say Guanyin's name enough, then she'll give me what I want. She'll take away my debt, or make me rich, or make me beautiful, or whatever. I think a lot of people do practice it in that way, but one doesn't have to. But just as a way of practicing, which takes one out of oneself, I've certainly come to places in my practice where I'm going full tilt. I'm practicing as hard as my capacities will let me in the present moment. I can't be more mindful than I can be in the present moment. So what do you do when you're there, when I'm going as hard as I can, and I've reached the wall of self-conscious effort? So my way of practicing with the Guanyin mantra is just invoking Guanyin, anything. It's a symbol for anything internal or external, conscious or unconscious, that could help me out. And I could totally conceive of it as just being just an allowance. If there's anything in my subconscious which can get me to let go, I'm up against the wall and I'm unable to let go. By reciting this name, anything in my psyche which I'm not yet aware of, and again, that's not really a self. I've gone as far as my Kovilo effort can take me at times in the present moment, given my conditions. So this invoking, this prayer almost, Guanyin, you know, a placeholder for invoking, may something else help me let go. So take that as you will. And the final reflection sphere of insight is Pure Land. And this is a perspective which I've gotten from Kittisaro. And I haven't fully taken it on, but I do find it also an interesting, perhaps, placeholder. So for people who don't know, the Pure Land is often what is framed in a Mahayana context as a realm, which someone, if you recite the Buddha's name a lot, i.e. Amitabha Buddha, who's the Buddha of the Pure Land, the Suddhavasa, the Sukhavati, then through that affinity, through all that recitation, you'll be reborn in the land of Pure Land, where all of the trees, all the birds, the wind, it's all teaching you Dhamma. You're born in a lotus and everything's beautiful, and it's basically just the best place to practice. And that's how the shorter and longer Pure Land Sutras kind of frame it. And many people, that's the belief. I recite Amitabha Buddha, Amitofo, Amitofo, Amitofo enough, then Amitabha will pick me up at the end of the life and drop me in this great place to be reborn. And, you know, someone could say, there's some people have speculated the Suddhavasa, the pure lands, literally, pure abodes of the non-returner in the Pali Canon might be these pure lands. Some people debate that, but regardless of that, there is this sutta, which I marked down there, Majjhima Nikaya number 120, the Sankharupapatti Sutta, or rebirth by choice, rebirth by aspiration, where the Buddha does say, for one who has a sufficient level of virtue and faith and knowledge and wisdom, if they have the wish, may I be reborn as a Brahmin, then they can be reborn as a Brahmin. Or if they have the wish, may I be reborn as a in the heaven of the great four great kings, or in the heaven of the 33, then that can happen. So this reappearance by aspiration, there is a precedence in the Pali Canon. And how Kittisara frames this, this pure land, is just as the optimal rebirth. And who, if one believes in rebirth, certainly you could frame it as an understanding of the optimal rebirth in the present moment, you know, but if one takes on a framework of rebirth, then who wouldn't want the optimal rebirth where you're born there and everything is teaching the Dhamma? You hear the Four Noble Truths from day one and you can understand it, and everything's beautiful, and everybody around you is a practitioner. You have great Dhamma conversations, and you know, everything's gold. I don't know, that doesn't sound so appealing to me, but it would probably be pretty. There's lapis lazuli, there's all sorts of treasures, but again, less exciting for me. But a fact, a place, or a rebirth, a becoming, where it's the best place for being reborn, and just taking this idea of the pure land as the symbol for that, I think is quite beautiful. So those are my 4 years and four lessons. So the emphasis on true suchness or thusness or being or emptiness or a non-dual appreciation of subjective awareness. Learning how to be a little bit less attached to views, this practice of Guanyin in the present moment, taking me out of myself and opening to that which is beyond and bigger and greater than myself, and Pure Land as a great place to be reborn. So with that, close up and open things up for questions. Okay. What Mahayana meditation practices have you incorporated into your practice, if any? So I do recite often a lot these days, somewhat of a Mahayana Theravada hybrid mantra. So again, I part of my psyche doesn't want to fully take on Mahayana practices. So the mantra in a Guanyin retreat is Guanyin Pusa, which Pusa means Bodhisattva. So homage to Guanyin Bodhisattva. So my mantra is Guanyin Budo, Budo being just awareness, and that being the Thai forest tradition, awareness of that which knows. So Guanyin is an opening energy. It's a listening energy, and this Budo is a knowing, or giving this intentionality to. So listening and speaking, opening, letting go, and being. So Guanyin Budo. And just mantra practice, there's great, the vigor with which you'll see people practice a city of 10,000 Buddhas is extremely impressive. I've seen this from before I ordained. I visited city of 10,000 Buddhas for a couple months. And yeah, you've got grandmas in their 70s, 80s who are just reciting Amitabha all day, every day in the Buddha hall. It's impressive. And some of the tunes, again, people might not feel comfortable if you've taken on the 8 precepts of not singing to recite a Mahayana kind of melody of Guanyin Bu, Guanyin Bu Sa, Guanyin Bu Sa, Guanyin Bu Sa. So I don't know how many notes that is, but it's more than the 3 of classical Theravada Yo So. But yeah, when I recite internally, that melody is helpful. It makes me want to do it more. So I like it. And I'm not out there other than just now. Please forgive me. That was an example. I'm not singing it out. I'm not making, you know, YouTube songs with me playing the drums and whatever, singing Mahayana songs. But internally, I do find that a great support for mindfulness. This is Ajahn Nisibo here. He says, great that we'll have you up here for long term, finally. Ajahn Nisibo, thank you so much. Great, brother. Yes, interdisciplinary study is life and diversity. Yeah, it's a great point. Yeah, anyone, everyone, even if you're a monk, you have to leave the monastery, the Buddha. Yeah, we have to go for alms every day, and we'll meet with association with the disliked at times, and separation from the liked, from that which is comfortable, that which is familiar, that which is uncomfortable with the rational, the coherent, the consistent Theravada. And I sometimes don't like the sometimes irrational, sometimes inconsistent, sometimes incoherent Mahayana, as I understand it. But yeah, diversity of perspective, being able to not make a problem out of that is a good skill. Yeah, your teaching will only make your teaching much, much richer. I hope that's the case. I do look forward to when I go back to, I have been reading lots of Mahayana sutras in addition to lots of secular texts. We also have a Western classic strand reading the Bible and the Odyssey and Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Nietzsche and Heidegger tomorrow and Indian classics, the Bhagavad Gita, the Ramayana, Chinese classics, the Tao Te Ching, the Confucian Analects, etc. So being able to focus back in on my love, Theravada, Pali Canon, yes. But yeah, having a broader perspective for anyone's teachings and conversations it's helpful. So I've noticed a particular openness to the Mahayana way of describing things in the teachings of Ajahn Amaro. Definitely. He's got a book called Small Boat, Great Mountain, which is specifically small boat, referring to the Hinayana, small Hinayana vehicle or boat. Great Mountain being a translation, I believe, of Mahamudra or Tibetan Mahayana practices. So Dzogchen specifically. But I wonder if he's been an influence on your journey. Congratulations on graduating, Ajahn. Thank you very much. He has been, probably consciously and unconsciously. So really, City of 10,000 Buddhas in general, Master Hua offered the land for Abhayagiri in the early 90s to Ajahn Sumedho. Master Hua, who is widely believed to have had psychic powers, said that Ajahn Sumedho and he were brothers and practitioners in previous lives. And so he offered the land for Abhayagiri to Abhayagiri. Ajahn Amaro had affinities with the Chinese Mahayana since at least the early 80s. He had a practice of reciting the heart of the Sharangama mantra, a Chinese Mahayana sutra mantra for like 3 years, every day, 108 times. That was in the early 80s. The name Abhayagiri was chosen, as I understand it, because the original Abhayagiri Vihara in Sri Lanka had these affinities between Mahayana. It had both Mahayana and Theravada, Mahayana and these older teachings, present monks practicing both. So I think that's why the name was chosen. Honestly, I feel much more comfortable with the Theravada, and that's my general inclination. But it's good to be, to be able to both speak more broadly and, to see where benefit can be found and to see how these different practices can be used. Another perspective is in Vajrayana, it goes one beyond both subject and object. To maybe both subject and object. And one can make a case that the Satipatthana Sutta, when it talks about, in each of the refrain of the Satipatthana Sutta, when I mentioned before, one knows mind is mind, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. One does this aware internally and externally, and both internally and externally, or just to the extent of knowing there is mind for the purpose of letting go. So I think that the final words in that refrain, one could say is a great kernel for, and perhaps pointing to the same thing which Vajrayana is pointing to there, subject to the internal, the object, the external, both internal and external. And again, if you don't like my interpretations, no worries, no problem. See how that feels. And if you can hold it in a way which isn't problematic for yourself, and it's not painful. I really honestly felt the dissonance of my understanding of these teachings, the dissonance of my attachment to these seemingly different views. It was painful. It was painful in my face, painful in my body. So when I was reading the biography of Ajahn Mun and how he encountered the arhants, etc., the first thing I was thinking about was the Lotus Sutra. Yeah, it's a good point. People should go back to Ajahn Mun. It is part of the curriculum at DRBU. He has these visions of not just arhants, but Buddhas and I believe Bodhisattvas. And it's not framed as just a hallucination, but by Ajahn Mun, who's widely believed also to have been an arhant, like Ajahn Mun is purported to have been. These are true, that's the way it's framed, encounters with arhants, bodhisattvas, Buddhas. So it does stretch one's classical understanding of Theravada. And because of that, there are people, very, very classical Theravadins who will say, obviously that's proof that Ajahn Mun had wrong view and wasn't an arhant because he talks about these things, or he reified self, or he talked about the mind is, people read his interpretation of the citta as being a self. But I would say, I would encourage people who have that kind of view to see how it feels to feel so adamantly and tightly, to hold so tightly to such a perspective. Greetings, Ajahn. Congratulations on your upcoming graduation. Thank you. I have a question about the citta. Do we say the citta or a citta? So spelling is C-I-T-T-A, although it is pronounced in English C-H, citta. Modern day teachers, you talk about the citta, the mind. It literally means mind. In a Abhidhamma context, things are broken down into individual mind moments, which are something like a trillionth of a second. You could talk about a citta in that perspective. So a mind moment of a citta mind moment. But sometimes, and this is what the people who I was just mentioning who find fault with modern ways, the Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mahabhua, maybe Ajahn Sumedho perspectives of talking about the citta, the mind is that which knows. When you say the citta, the mind, it does seem to reify it because it takes it through time. So Yeah, well, I think that might be all we can cover for this evening. Looks like there are a lot more questions. Apologies we didn't get to them all, but we will be continuing on Zoom. I'm going to post a link in the chat. And that's just a great way to continue the conversation. It's more interactive and would love to hear what people's perspectives are about the interplay between these things and what it feels like to be attached to views and what it feels like to be able to let go of views, to still have them, but not cling to them. And anything else that we've touched on tonight. So I hope people can join us there. That goes from right now until 7:30. So see all of you there. And this weekend, a big weekend on Friday in Seattle. I'll be going up there tomorrow, Thursday, May 2nd. On Friday, May 3rd, Ajahn Jayasaro, and you can find all of this on the Clear Mountain website. Ajahn Jayasaro will be teaching at Sims. On Saturday, he'll be teaching at Fauntleroy for the usual morning teaching in English. And on Sunday, he'll be teaching at St. Mark's, the usual place, and that will be in Thai, a Thai teaching. And then he'll be teaching in Vancouver on Monday, and Wat Budanasorn on Monday for the meal, Vancouver in the evening. So I hope all of you can join those in person. He's an amazing, amazing teacher and an extremely sweet teacher. So just hope to see all of you, any of you there in person, and hope everyone has a good evening and see all of you who can make it over on Zoom. All right, have a good night.